You are listening to another Screenfish One-on-One, this time live with director Lech Majewski. Majewski is the director of Valley of the Gods, which stars Josh Hartnett as a writer who is given the opportunity to write a biography for the wealthiest man in the world, played by John Malkovich. In this one-on-one, we speak to Majewski about working with the Navajo culture in the preparation for the film, what it means to have power, and how his career in cinematography has influenced his filmmaking. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. And I'm thrilled that I could get a hold of you. Valley of the Gods is just stunning.
Thank you very much.
Where did the idea for the film come from?
Well, it came from the when I first visited the Valley of the Gods, the real Valley of the Gods, and I was looking for a landscape to my movie called The Gospel According to Harry, which was a debut of Viggo Mortensen, and I visited with a location scout all the deserts of America, of the Western America, and Valley of the Gods had the tremendous impact on me. And when I was invited to Sundance with The Mill and the Cross, I booked a flight to Las Vegas, and then I took a car and went back through Utah into the Valley of the Gods, and it was 2011. And I knew that I have to do a movie there. I mean, the space was calling me, so to say. And then when I entered the world of the Navajo mythology and all the legends, and I found the similarities with the Hittite Anatolia, which is now Turkey. Yes, it's the area where the Troy was, when the... It's very near Troy, where the Battle of Troy was. So there are similar legends there, and Indian Navajo has. And also when I met the indigenous people and I spoke with them, I befriended them, and they accepted me, then I wanted to tell the story from a little bit from their point of view.
That was one of the things I loved about the film, and I was wondering how you went about preparing for the film in regards to Navajo culture. It sounds like you really did your best to tell it from their perspective, from their point of view.
Yes, very much so. I mean, their perspective is closer to magic, and to we the white people, we use the cause and effect logic. And their logic is more deep, it's paradoxical, but yet it's very profound. It was striking for me how connected they are to their ancestors and how often they talk with them, and they get messages from them, the directions even, and also they are absolutely aware that if they physically will die, they will still be connecting with their grandchildren and caring for them and giving them advice. It's so natural for them. There is somehow the death doesn't exist in the sense that we have the existence of death. It's incredible, this chain of spiritual, I would say a spiritual river that goes through them. They only know that they are here physically for a moment, yet the river started a long time ago and has a long way to go.
With that in mind, one of the things I thought was so fascinating about this film is the nature of power. Because you hold up two very distinct types of power within the film, between the Navajo in the more spiritual sense and with Taurus and his financial power. I was wondering what you think it means to have power and how you wanted to present that within the film.
Well, for me, it was interesting to see the powerlessness of power. I mean, when I was preparing Basquiat, which I gave Julian Schnabel to direct, but I wrote the original story. I interviewed a lot of very, very powerful people in the United States. And the thing that came across these conversations was how powerless they are. I mean, the common sense of a super rich person is that this person is really like the king of its own destiny. And the truth of the matter is that they're the fragile humans and subjected to the same suffering and even more of loneliness than, let's say, an average person has. Because they're very limited with their freedom. I mean, they cannot just enjoy their freedom in a natural way. There always will be a threat of a kidnapping, or somebody in the family will be kidnapped, or, you know, sickness, death, and what have you. I mean, things that, do not look at money or power. So it was incredible for me. So I wanted to clash this absolute material poverty from our standpoint that is characteristic to the Navajo people. Like, they really live in archaic way. They don't have running water. They do not have electricity very often. Now it a little bit changes because there are the solar panels that can help. But many of these people, especially those who live on the grazing grounds, they do not have all these amenities that are natural to us. Yet I never felt in their abodes, in their hogans, in their houses, I never felt a kind of emptiness and solitude, which is characteristic to us. I mean, one of the most precious items in their space is water. So when I visited an old Navajo woman, she sat me on an armchair which was constructed from the containers with water. So it was interesting. Every particular piece of furniture was a container for water. That was the gold and the pressure thing that she possessed. And then she was telling me about her grandmother who came to her in the dream, and she was yelling at her and demanding that she would treat certain horse in her Mustangs in a different way. And she knew that she made a mistake, and she was very sorry to her grandmother. And then she told me that when she will see that her granddaughter will do similar mistakes, she will come to her and tell her that.
Wow.
it was unusual. Yes, I mean, and at the same time, these people who are the heart of America, of the United States of America, like a forgotten society, like an abandoned society in a certain way. And their territory, the Navajo Nation, is surrounded by the epitome of riches, like, you know, not far away you have Silicon Valley or Palm Springs or the capital of Kitsch, Las Vegas. And people roaming the fluorescent streets in order to find some luck. So that's the take.
One of the more striking images, too, as we talk about that a little bit, to me, is the moment when we see multiple people who are trapped. They're in cages. They're imprisoned, and they have the option to leave. Yet almost all of them decide to stay. And I was wondering, what do you think that we often choose to remain in a prison at the hands of power, or what does it mean to be free?
My feeling is that everybody talks about freedom, but people don't know what to do with this. And actually, one of the philosophers said that the freedom, you reach the real freedom when you bind yourself to someone or to something. And so it's a tricky question, because people talk about freedom, yet they're totally afraid of it. They would actually die of fear when they would reach the real freedom. I mean, freedom of speech, freedom of real independent thinking, and that's a dangerous territory. It's not certainly you put them out of society, which is more like a health freedom.
With that sort of in mind, the film also looks at the idea of what it means to lean into absurdity. I was wondering what you think in our culture is truly absurd, and what it means to lean into that.
Well, it is getting more and more absurd in terms that we're moving away from the human nature, so to say. And like I observe, like film festivals turn into kind of an ideological battlegrounds rather than the art of filmmaking. And in many respects, the same happens in the art world and in the publishing business and so forth and so on. The ideology seems to be more important than the merit or the quality of artwork. And that's a dangerous thing, because I grew up in ideology and the communist Poland, and I saw how it can twist and change and suppress people in the name of lofty ideas. So, you know, the biggest suffering is always brought to us by people who want to relieve us and rescue us, make us happy. So, by nature, I will always remain suspicious of the ideological solutions, so to say.
I really appreciate the chance to speak with you. And as we start to wrap up, the film is so cinematic. And I know that much of your career, you've been a cinematographer as well. I was wondering how your career as a cinematographer has influenced your vision for filmmaking.
Well, I started as a painter, you know, and therefore image is always very important. And I very strongly believe in this Chinese saying that the image is worth 1,000 words. So I'm trying to visualize. I also think it's a deeper language. It's a language that we receive much on a much subliminal and deeper level than the spoken language, which is often abused and misused and limited. You know, that's a characteristic that I believe in, that when somebody, let's say, in cinema or in a museum looks at the image, whatever it is, whether the image is moving or static like a painting, the language that is associated with receiving that image is very limited. I don't think that people verbalize these elements. Also, people do not verbalize their feelings or the complexity of their feelings, because they usually use a single word for something. I hate it, I love it, I this, I that. It's like putting a stamp on it, but rather than seeing the complexity of it. But on a deeper level, people perceive those images and people receive them in a deeper, unspoken a level of themselves. So that's how I view it. Therefore, I'm trying to use this visual language. I study it, I lecture about it, and I use it.
Well, it's so beautiful. And every scene, you feel so small. whether you're in the palace or whether you're in the desert, there's a scope to it that is just marvelous.
Well, thank you.
It looks beautiful. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you about it.
Okay, thank you. And when you have something, send me.